Today is September 5th, 2017. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am sitting here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, and conducting an oral history with rock writer, musician, and all-around community person, Paul Liberatore. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me and talk. We are sitting in the IJ offices right now at 4000 Civic Center Drive. And these are offices
in San Rafael.
And so it's very nice to be in your work world. I know so many people know you from your work. But before we begin, I'd love to learn a little bit about your family history, a little context to understand what brought you to Marin and how long you've been here. Let's start where you were born.
I was born in Yonkers, New York, in June 1945. And my biological father, who is a senior, Paul Liberatore Sr., died a month after I was born. He was a Marine. He was in the South Pacific. And he contracted cancer towards the end of the war, of all things. And they brought him back, and he died at the Naval Hospital in, I think, in Brooklyn.
Oh,
yeah.
My.
In July 1945, I was a month old.
And how old was he?
27. 27 years old. So I never knew my biological father. And my mother, several years later, 3 or 4 years later, remarried my biological father's best friend. They grew up together in this Italian neighborhood in Yonkers. And he was in the Army, my father was in the Marines. After the war, my mother remarried him. And they moved us to Southern California. He moved the family to Southern California. Then it was just me and my mother. And so I grew up primarily in the Santa Clarita Valley, which is about 30 miles northwest of LA.
And your mother's name?
My mother's name is Margaret Cacciatore, C-A-C-C-I-A-T-O-R-E.
Wait.
And my stepfather's name is Rocco G. Cacciatore. Italian.
Liberatore.
Liberatore and
Cacciatore. Yeah. From the same region?
They're in the same town, city, you know, Yonkers, New York, right? They're first generation, you know, their parents were from Italy.
Uh-huh.
Some of my mother's... some of my father's, my biological father's sisters and brothers were born in Italy, actually.
What part
but
of
he
Italy?
Wasn't. They're from, where are they from? I'll have to think. My mother's from Bari, but my father is from, can't recall at the moment, because I've only learned this fairly recently, so I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. Just the similarity of the name is a little confusing.
Yeah, well, you know, Italian kids, they grew up, they're friends. They're on the same football team in high school. I have a picture of both my father, my stepfather, and my biological father, you know, playing together. You can see them both, them tackling some guy, you know. And so they were pals.
Do you suppose that...
And they both dated my mother at the same time, so...
Wait, what?
They both dated my mother. They're all friends, you know, they were all friends and ran around the same crowd. And they always wondered which one my mother would marry, and she ended up marrying them both.
I wonder if that helped him to be more open, more available to you, knowing that it was his dear friend's son.
Who knows? I mean, he had two other kids. I have a brother, actually, who both live here in Marin County, and a sister.
And their names?
James Cacciatore. Mm-hmm. He's a photographer and sometimes works for the IJ. So he and I do stories together often, you know. We get paired to go out and do stories, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a sister who lives out in Bolinas, named Kathy Sanchez Correa, her name is.
Mm.
And they're a kind of an old Marin family.
And that's from the second, the stepfather.
Yeah, they're
so
my
So you're the elder
half
brother.
They're half brother and half sister. Yeah, I'm the oldest.
The elder, wiser brother.
Older and wiser, I mean.
So you ended up in Southern California. How old were you when you moved there?
Like six or six. I was in first grade, whatever that is.
Because you don't have a Bronx or
no.
That you do.
No. My parents
your
had
accent
kind of an accent. Some people, some
not
people
even
do.
An Italian
no,
accent,
no,
nothing.
No.
Your California
yeah.
eyes.
Yeah, I'm a California kid. You know.
Yeah. So you came to Southern California and... This is in what year? I say this because 50s, of the music scene.
Yeah, 1951, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I was 6 years old, 7 years old, whatever it was. You know.
Do you remember the differences going from the East Coast to the West?
Oh, yeah, I remember learning to read, you know, in New York, actually, in Yonkers. I remember, by the time I came in the first grade, I could already read. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know one thing I do remember is the kids in my class were much farther behind me, you know. So I'm glad I had that phonetic training and reading. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of ahead of the game from when I started here in school in California.
Did you, this is a while back, the world was different. It wasn't as crowded, certainly. Right. But you were living in areas, I don't know about El Cerrito, how concentrated, more of a suburban area there.
Santa Clarita. It was farm country. Yeah, it was Newhall land and farming. It was alfalfa fields and onion fields and carrot fields.
So you went from Yonkers, a more concentrated population.
Yeah, I went from an urban area to a very rural Southern California high desert, foothills of Tehachapi Mountains.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's completely developed. There's like, those days we had one high school, mm-hmm. William S. Hart High School I went to, I was graduated from. It's named after the first silent movie cowboy, William S. Hart, who was had a ranch there in the town.
Mm-hmm.
So the school was named after him. Yeah.
How was it for you making that move? Did you?
You know, I was so young, and I'd been to California before for a couple of years. My stepfather went to college here for a couple of years. He started off in junior college and went to Berkeley for a year, and then he finished at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to finish it, and then we came back again. So I'd been moving around quite a lot already. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah.
So you went on. You graduated from high school.
Yeah.
Then you went on to college.
Right on to San Diego State, yeah.
San Diego mm-hmm. State University.
Yeah, I was kind of a surfer kid, you know, growing up down there, so that was a natural place for me to go.
And
yeah.
What year were you there?
I was there from 63 to 68.
How was that?
Oh, great, you know. It was great. I think I really grew up there. And plus, it was during the Vietnam War, so it was always hanging over one's head, you know, mm-hmm. sort of Damocles to trying to resist the draft. And my student deferment ran out, and I suddenly realized that I was a sole surviving son. My father died, you know, during World War II. He was a military, he was a Marine when he died. And I was never adopted formally. Oh. So I'm the only one in my family with my last name. So because of that, I went and applied for a sole surviving son status. You know, being the only one left to carry on the family name, and I was given it, granted it. And that's how I got out of the draft.
Holy yikers.
Yeah.
That wasn't easy to... I mean, people would have paid big money for that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a lottery was going on. I had a really good lottery number, too.
Uh-huh.
But nevertheless, you know, I didn't need it, really, because uh-huh. I'd already done that. So...
So you went on to San Diego State.
So I graduated from San Diego State.
And you
I got married in my last year there.
Over at San Diego State?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I married a girl from Whittier, from... you know, Southern California, and we had a child that born in 1968. The year I graduated, she was born.
And her name?
Leslie.
And she was born while you were in San Diego?
Well, I was in school, yeah. And then, so we graduated, and I went into the offices of the San Diego Union, because I knew that the thing that I could do the best was write. You know, so I used to write my new roommates papers. You know, they'd say, I need a paper, it's due tomorrow. What's it about? And I would write it, and they would, you know, give me
so did
six pack or something.
Yeah.
So I did, you know, I knew I could do that, you know, and I'd actually gotten a couple of little clips, you know, from some friends of mine had a neighborhood magazine, so I got a couple of little clips. And I marched into the office of the San Diego Union and said, you know, that I wanted a job, and they said, well, did you take journalism in college? No.
What did you take?
I took political science and public administration. And I took a lot of English classes and everything, so, you know, I was up to speed as far as that goes, but I never really took any journalism. I was on the high school paper in school, in high school.
When but you just, did you have an innate sense of always that you wanted to be a writer? Or
I knew I wanted to be, that's what I did the best. I knew that I could do that. So what did I do best? I can do that best. And my stepfather made sure that I learned how to type. He said, Paul, he said, I see how you use tools and things like that, and you're not very good. So he said, you'd better take typing. You know, so I had to go to summer school to take typing.
Back then, they didn't really push typing on men.
No, I was the only guy in the class, which was great. You know, I said, wow, this is pretty cool. I think I took it twice. So I learned how to type, which was a godsend. Because that's when they asked me, they said, well, do you like newspapers? And I said, yeah, I grew up on the L.A. Times. It landed in the driveway every day. I'd run out, pick it up, bring it in, show it to my father, and, you know, grab the sports section or whatever it was, you know. Oh, good. And you can type? Yeah. Can you start in 2 weeks in L.A.? I said, yeah, I can start in 2 weeks. So I packed up my wife and kids and moved to L.A. and started working for... I was in an internship program first. So I worked on the San Pedro News Pilot. No, I worked on the Culver City Star News first, then the Alhambra Post Advocate for a couple of years.
The what?
The Alhambra Post Advocate.
Oh, the Alhambra Post Advocate.
And then I was hired full-time at the San Pedro News Pilot.
And where was that located?
All in Southern California.
All in Southern?
Yeah.
What was your beat?
Oh, everybody starts as a cop reporter, police reporter.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Everybody that goes to work for a newspaper starts as a police
Most
reporter?
Most cop reporters start as a police reporter.
So what is that like?
Well, for me, it was like going into the Harbor District of the LAPD, which is heavy duty. I'll never forget, it was Kent State. The day I went in there during Kent State, right after Kent State. And all the cops are going, yeah, they should have shot more of them. You know, and I'm going, oh, my God. You know?
Well, did you have long hair?
I had long hair. I drove a Volkswagen bus. And it had a grape strike sticker on the back, bumper sticker on the back.
Uh-huh.
The first day I drove into San Pedro, I just drove into the town. I got pulled over immediately by the police. What are you doing here? What are you da 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 da? I'm starting today, so I'm going to work for the paper, the news pilot. Okay, make sure.
I don't know if young people are quite aware of the profiling that went on.
Oh, man.
If you were a hippie, or God forbid, gay, or the wrong color in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, it was scary. And my first job as a news reporter ended because of politics. You know, the newspaper was owned by Copley Newspapers, which is a...
What's the name?
Copley, C-O-P-L-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, they were, I don't know if they're still active or not, probably. But they're very right-wing.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, you know, the differences were kind of like now, you know, but maybe even more in some ways. And so the paper was really conservative, right-wing all the way down the line. And I would be assigned, there was a military base in town, Fort MacArthur is called. And so there, every once in a while there'd be an anti-war protest there, or some sort of thing around the California farm workers
strike. Because
Cesar
Chavez was
all
there.
Those,
yeah.
All that stuff, you know, and San Pedro's a big labor town. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a port, so there's a lot of longshoremen. And really interesting place, you know, culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go out and cover these events, the war protests or this or that or the other, and I'd take all my own photographs and we'd develop them and everything. I'd write up my story, and it wouldn't run. I noticed it wasn't running in the paper, and these guys would come in, obviously they look like undercover police people, and pick up my copy and leave, you know, and this managing editor would, you know,
let them.
So I finally...
Why are they paying you?
I guess they paid me to be some sort of an agent, you know, for the police, but I wasn't going to do that.
No. Oh.
So I'll never forget it, the managing editor, who I won't name, but anyway, took me into the wire room one day, which is where they had the machines, you know, the wire machines in those days, and it was noisy in there, and all their clattering away, and he said, here, I want you to write this piece on the John Birch Society, you know, a nice... good piece about the good
You mean supportive of the Birch.
Yeah, supportive of them.
And even back then, everybody knew about the John Birch Society.
Yeah. So I said, well, you know, I'm not doing it. In fact, he handed me, I just threw it on the floor, and I said, listen, if you were running my stuff, when I go out to these war protests or the farm worker stuff, you're not running it, I see what you're doing. And I said, I would write this gladly if there was some balance around here, but there isn't, so I'm not doing it. And I went back and sat down and put my head down and expected to get thrown out the door. Didn't happen. So I called, I went home that night, I called the newspaper guild. We were guild, luckily.
Uh-huh.
And they told me, don't go in tomorrow, we'll figure this out. He said, you know, and you know, we'll we'll back you, however. And so I went in the day after that. And I was called into the publisher's office, and I stated my case. That's all I could do. And the publisher was not aware of this that was going on. So I really came off pretty well. And the managing editor was kind of squirming around. You know, I don't think the publisher knew what was going on. So they didn't fire me. They didn't fire me, which was amazing. But I knew my days were numbered there. So I went back. I worked for a short while longer, and then I got a job as a social worker for Los Angeles County, briefly.
As a social worker?
Social worker.
Yeah, but you had no training.
Well, you don't need any training. You know, I had a degree, and they'll train you. All it is filling out a bunch of forms. And it's like, I worked in South Central LA. I had 130 black women clients. And in those days, you know, I had to go do home visits and all this stuff. You know.
Well, you certainly can't do that now, today,
no.
Without training.
It was pre-crack, too. You know, I'd probably be killed if I'm getting some white kid driving around there. But anyway, I did it for about 18 months. And then we moved to Marin in 1972, December 1972.
What prompted the move?
My wife's mother and sister lived in Marin already.
And your wife's Fairfax. Name again?
My first wife.
Okay, let's hear the first
one. Her name now is Linda Bell, and she still lives in Fairfax. She's been remarried for many years, 30-some years.
So go on. You were saying.
So I had by then I had two children, two daughters, and we moved to Fairfax, and I didn't have a job actually, and I worked in the Sleeping Lady Cafe for a week. It was a co-op in those days, and Peter Tork was working there from the Monkees.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and it was a trip, you know. And I was in back there washing these pots, you know, for a week. At the end of the week, I got my pay, and it was like $16, something like that, which I immediately used to buy a lid of pot.
And you're how old now?
I was 27.
So you're 27 with two girls.
Two girls, and I came home and I said, you know, well, I worked a week at the Sleeping Lady, and this is what I've got. And my wife just looked at me and said, Paul, you just got to get a real job somewhere.
And then you told me again, I forget why you came, because of her work?
No, because her mother and sister lived here.
Oh, so she comes.
They lived in Marin already, so,
yes.
You know.
So, wait, she's not even working, and you're washing
neither
dishes
one of us was
and
working.
Smoking up your $16.
I didn't get a chance to smoke it. But you know, I had applied at the IJ earlier during the strike. You know, the IJ had a very, very serious.
Let's talk about that.
Strike. Well, I wasn't here then, so, but I was actually called when I was in LA working as a reporter. I got called by the publisher of the Independent Journal to come up and work, but I would have had to been scammed to do it. And I said, no, I can't do that.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the strike lasted, I think it ended in 1971.
And what was it predicated on?
Well, it was I'm not sure. It was about the pressmen or something, but it was, I remember seeing pictures come across the wire when I was working in Southern California of the strike, and it looked like Flint, Michigan in the 30s. Cops with truncheons beating on people. There was a murder, somebody was murdered, you know.
And there was a line, and you could cross it or not cross it?
Yeah, and I wasn't going to cross it. So I told him, no, I can't do that. And then after the strike was broken, then I moved up here. And then I reapplied, and I got called. You know, luckily, after the Sleeping Lady debacle, you know, I got called to, as a stringer. You know, they wanted to test me out. So I think I covered the College of Marine Board, the first thing I covered.
Oh.
Can't think of anything more deadly than that.
Yes, that's dangerous.
So, you know, and I'd already done all this stuff, so I kind of had a leg up on it. So they brought me into the office, and I started, and then I got hired full-time.
You've been here since 72?
No, I was here till 79, and then I went to the Chronicle in 79, from 79 to 89.
Okay.
So 10 years, a whole decade, I was, the 80s I spent in the city.
Tell me something. You got a call. Had you put out ticklers all around? Did you send your information? Did they just find you? How to?
Who? What's that?
When people are contacting you, the IJ, yes.
I had reapplied.
You had
applied once, you know, before the strike, and then they wanted to hire me during the strike.
I mean, because they contacted you when you were in Southern California. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you had applied.
I had been up visiting my mother-in-law.
So you had anticipated the possibility of moving.
Yeah, we were just thinking about moving up here, but, you know, I thought it would be great if I get a job first, you know. Instead of the way I did it.
Right, okay. Because I didn't know if you were notorious for writing this particular kind of articles that weren't being printed, but your work had been... No, it was simply, practically speaking...
Yeah. It was just we needed to get out of L.A., and we had family here, and, you know, it's Marin County. I'm so
you were in
1972,
you're in Fairfax, which is different, don't you think, than it was then?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I remember it snowed, 1970. It snowed. I thought it was going to snow every year. I thought, wow, this is cool, it's snowing. I don't think it ever snowed again, but it did then. Yeah. So the IJ called me, and I worked my way back into the business. Uh-huh. And I worked here. I worked for the IJ the first time from 72 to 79.
And you worked as?
I was a general assignment reporter and a feature writer. And
a general what?
General assignment. Report.
Assignment, yes.
Yeah. So one of the things I did was I worked in the Mill Valley Bureau. You know, I was one of the first beats, my first real beat after I passed my, whatever they call a trial period on it, was assigned to the Mill Valley Bureau. So I had to show up there every morning at 8 a.m. and they knew if I was late, I'd drive from Fairfax, you know, looking for Fairfax, to Mill Valley. And there were two reporters, and there were some ad
And where
people.
Was the bureau office?
319 Miller Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there. You know, it's not a newspaper office anymore, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But so I started, you know, covering Mill Valley, essentially. It was one of the first beats. Not just Mill Valley, but also Tiburon and Belvedere and West Marin. I did a lot of stuff out of Bolinas in those days.
Any particular stories come to mind?
Well, that's how I met Mimi Farina.
Uh-huh. And for those who may be too young to know who Mimi is?
Mimi Farina is the younger sister of Joan Baez. And she was married to Richard Farina, who was a musician and novelist. They did a couple of albums for, I think, Vanguard in the 60s that were pretty well known and successful. See, Reflections on a Great Day and a Gray Day and one other. I can't remember the titles right now, but I remember having them when I was
that
kid.
Mimi and her husband had made together because she performed as well.
Yeah, they performed as a duo, Richard mm-hmm. and Mimi Farina.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard was subsequently killed on Mimi's 21st birthday in a motorcycle accident in Carmel Valley.
Mm.
The day his book had been published, his first book, Richard
was a writer
quite
as well.
Yeah, Thomas Pynchon was the best man at their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he wrote a book called Been Down So Long, It Looks Like Up to Me.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So then after that, Mimi went on to her own career, you know, as a folk singer. She worked for the committee. She worked with the committee in San Francisco, which was a sketch comedy, early sketch comedy group with people like Howard Hessman and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1974, she was working with another singer named Tom Janz, and they had done an album together. And so when I met her, she came into the IJ Bureau office in Mill Valley one day in 1974, saying that she just started this organization to take live music into places, into institutions, places where people couldn't get out and see live entertainment, you know. Senior centers, prisons was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she got the idea from watching B.B. King perform at Sing Sing Prison in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so impressed by that, and that gave her the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so she started that in 74 and came into the office with Tom, you know, as they call. And of course, like everybody else, every other man of my generation, I was immediately smitten, you know. She was so beautiful. She's charismatic, you know, and so she said, would you like to do a story on the organization? And I was like, yeah, I'll do a story, of course, it's great. It was a great story, too, you know, on top of it. And so the first, I think I did one of the first stories ever on Bread and Roses.
And that's the name of her foundation,
Bread and Roses. Yeah.
Then
yeah. Still going.
Actually. Yes, still going.
Yeah.
And talk just for those listening a little bit about the extent of what Bread and Roses meant to Marin County and to others. I mean, yeah. This was quite an organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's been going for how many years is that? You know, she led the organization for 25 years mm-hmm. until she retired.
Yeah. And she engaged so many local musicians.
Oh, I mean, yes, not only local musicians, but also nationally known. I mean, she did these big festivals at the Greek Theater in Berkeley. That's how we got to become friends first. I wrote a lot of the programs for those. I mean, Chris Christopherson, Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, Stephen Stills, Hoyt Axe. I mean, it's a huge long list of people who did that. And those festivals were amazing at the Greek.
You know? I think there's some people that may have thought that those festivals were called Bread and Roses without even realizing that it was a foundation it was supporting, because the music was so amazing.
Yeah.
I remember some of those concerts. Yeah. It was just one great performer after another.
And yes. Beautiful, the setting was amazing.
And the sun might be setting and you'd see one amazing performer singing all by themselves, not surrounded by the band. I'll never forget the haunting quality of hearing such beautiful music.
Yeah, and she always wanted it to be acoustic, mostly acoustic. I mean, it could be amped a little bit just so you could hear. But she didn't want, it wasn't like electric rock bands. It was mostly acoustic style.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it had that folk, very personal quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was important to her.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one I covered with her was in 74, was they were going to go into San Quentin
mm-hmm.
on New Year's Day, 1975, to... with a concert with Boss Skaggs and his partner Les Dudek and some bunch of other people. And there was a lockdown in San Quentin like the day before, so we couldn't go in. So what happened was she had everybody come to her house in Mill Valley up in the hills on Panoramic. She bought this house up there. And so Joan was there, Boss Skaggs was there, Les Dudek, I said, Congress of Wonders, John Hendricks, Joan, Paul Krasner, a long list of people, notable people. And they recorded it. They all performed in her living room, and they recorded it to be broadcast on the San Quentin radio station. And my job was, I went into one of the bedrooms or one of the office rooms and interviewed everybody. So you know, that was my job. So I did that, you know. And you know, Mimi and I became friends that way. And then we became further friends during the festival years when I would write the programs for her. We would hang out a little bit. And it was sort of a flirtation in those days. It wasn't quite the right time. It didn't work out. But you know, that would happen later.
Oh,
yeah.
Did it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't know this story?
Well, you've I may have that. Heard a thing or two, but those listening may not have.
Yeah, right. Well, in 1997, I think, I separated from my second wife. And
your second wife's name was?
Karen.
Is?
Karen Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
She was a journalist. She worked at the IJ and the Chronicle, though, and still is. You know, doesn't write for them anymore. Doesn't live here anymore, but... that was my second one. We were married 17 years, something like that.
Really? So the first wife lasted...
8 years.
18?
Eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
Karen and I were married 17 years.
And then that came to...
That came to an end. And then Mimi and I were together from 97 till her death in 2001.
A sad time.
Yeah. So we had two... We had two healthy years and two not healthy years.
Was it breast cancer?
It was lung cancer.
Lung cancer.
That metastasized to lots of places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a neuroendocrine kind of cancer, which is, it's not particularly rare, but it's not that common either.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was separated from my wife. I was living out in Stinson Beach, and I ran into Mimi at the Whole Foods and on the way to work, and one thing led to another, and so we finally, you know, became a couple then, you know, from 97, as I said, until she died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then during that time, she left Bread and Roses. She retired from Bread and Roses and had this big 25th anniversary concert at the San Francisco Opera House.
Because mm-hmm. she was retiring because of her health.
Yeah, there was no, actually not. No, she wasn't ill then. Mm-hmm. When she left Bread and Roses, she had not been diagnosed. She may have, I don't know, you know, cancer, you never know when it manifests or how long it's been dormant, but she wasn't, you know, it wasn't because she didn't leave because she was ill necessarily, mm-hmm. but it was just time to go, I guess.
How many years had she been running Bread?
25 years. Well. Yeah, so they had this big 25th anniversary show. Chris Christopherson, Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt, Pete Seeger, Joan, mm-hmm. who else? Lots of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite a big deal. Mm-hmm. And she was there. She had been undergoing chemotherapy, so she lost all her hair. So she had this amazing silver turban, you know. She looked beautiful. You know? And I'll never forget, you know, she got up there to give her talk, you know, at the beginning of the concert. No notes or anything. And just let her rip, you know. It was so moving and I was so amazed at how she could do that. Because it was so emotional. Everybody knew what was going on, you know, of course.
Mm-hmm. But, I wish that the people hearing this could see you when you talk about her. I mean, you really do kind of glow. I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, she was special. You know, she really was. She wasn't easy. She was a very complicated person, but she was really committed to that. I mean, that was probably her children. You know, she never had children, really. Mm-hmm. So I think Bread and Roses was her purpose, you know, her mission, you know. So, mm-hmm. yeah, she was pretty amazing woman.
So all this while you're writing, you worked as this is going on, you were first working at the IJ, and then you're working with the Chronicle, you said, for 10 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of work were you doing with the Chronicle?
Well, I was kind of I was a young gun, kind of. You know, they'd say, I remember one of the first big assignments I ever had. Well, the first big assignment was a big kidnapping up in Ukiah, you know. It was the Stainer kidnapping. You remember that? It was this guy kidnapped his little kids.
Oh.
And kept them for a long time, and he kidnapped a second child.
Oh, this was a terrible story.
It was a terrible story.
Oh, he was, I hate to say, but anyway.
Oh, no.
Eventually, the man kidnapped a young boy, and the older boy finally snapped, and they escaped with the younger boy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was my first story.
Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, this was huge.
Yeah, it was a big story then.
And
it was a really big story.
Sadly, the older boy did not live much longer. He died in a motorcycle accident.
That's right.
Yes.
That's good. That's very good.
Yes, yeah. I remember.
Yep, that's right. And I think the younger one died too. I'm not sure, but I think Timothy White.
Yes.
I'm not sure, but I seem to remember.
This was a sensational story.
It was a sensational story, absolutely.
And had a lot of coverage all over the valley and mm-hmm. in California.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't usually, it's not common for the victims to somehow manage to escape in the way that they did. And then, and why didn't they before, or the older boy before?
Oh, right.
All the questions and
unanswered. All that psychological things,
yes.
Right.
And then, of course, the heinous nature of the whole experience.
Right.
I remember when the kidnapper, what was his name?
Parnell
was in the Fresno lockup, I believe.
Yeah.
I thought it's going to be.
That's where they kidnapped him. You know more about that. You remember more than I do.
Yes, they're going to have a lynching here. You know, I wondered at the time it was.
Yeah. I forget what his first name is. Parnell. Anyway, he was the. He was like the night manager, creepy thing. Night manager of the hotel where I stayed when I was there. But I was just given an assignment. You know, I was a young guy. You know, why don't you go up and cover the story? And I had the clothes on my back. I went up there. We need you to stay there. I don't have anything. You know, go buy yourself some clothes and a toothbrush.
And there being
the city desk of the San Francisco Chronicle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was my baptism of fire, and I got into it. You know, it was a national story. Well, so it was exciting as all hell.
And also important.
It was important, it was exciting, and I was competing against, you know, everybody. You know, all the big-time reporters, we all meet in the bar at the hotel at the end of the day. And
the hotel is?
I think the Ukiah Hotel. It was all remodeled. It had been redone with antiques, and it was very kind of bed and breakfasty even then. It was kind of a cool, you know, place to
I think out. Pot money had started to
maybe that's what
help revitalize the buildings in the town by
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was like I was gung-ho on that story. And I think I was up there for weeks at a time.
Did you interview anyone directly in the story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, lots of people. I mean, it was a 24/7 story. You mm-hmm. know, I worked it hard, you know, for every single day until it resolved, you know, mm-hmm. but that was my baptism of fire, and it was, you know, it was the best, it was so much fun, you know. It was hard work, but it was great fun.
And a hard story to write about.
A hard story to write about, but I mean, I was in a position to do it. I was right the age, and I had enough experience, I knew what I was doing.
So you felt you could do justice to it?
I'm a bulldog when it comes to stuff like that. I don't like getting beat. It's the worst feeling in the world to have somebody go, hey, the examiner's got this, how come you don't? I don't ever want to hear that. I never wanted to hear that. So I worked hard and got some scoops. And at one point, I forget the reason, I can't remember all the reason, but the public defender or the DA or somebody called me in. You know, they subpoenaed me to say somehow I got something or other, you know, some piece of information.
Oh,
so
really?
I found myself getting like, in this becoming the story, which none of us wants to do.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember. It didn't last long, but you know, but that's how close I was to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the kind of guy that for a few years that they used for things like that. You know, they'd say, Thanksgiving, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? Well, my family, well, we need you to go up to Reading, up to Mount Shasta, and do a story on the closing of this lumber mill. It's a town store, you know. The whole town is around this lumber mill. And they're closing it on Thanksgiving, and we want you to go up and do this poignant, heart-bending story. And you fly, and they said, fly up with one of our photographers who was a pilot. So we got in this little plane and flew up, landed on some little airstrip, nobody there, you know. Okay, Paul, jump out and put those things under the wheel, you know.
It really does seem kind of exciting in the telling.
Oh, it was great. Those were the best years of my life, I think. You know, as a writer, as a reporter. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff like that. They needed somebody, you know, there I was, you know. And I got good at it, too. And then I became the rewrite guy, which is in those days, that was a kind of a honored position. If you could be the rewrite guy.
So a rewrite. Describe that process.
A rewrite guy in those days was, if there was a big story breaking, a fire, a flood, murder, whatever, and you had reporters in the field, they would all funnel their information into the news desk, you know, the city desk, and then that would be funneled to me. So I took all the stuff from everybody else and made it into a story on Deadline.
And who got credit for the story?
I did.
Not all those that funneled
it? No.
Wow.
That's the way it worked. You wrote it, you got the byline.
Wow.
Yeah. Nowadays, you know, they put so-and-so contributed.
Names. Yes.
Yeah, sometimes there were multiple names, mm-hmm. but most of the time, the rewrite guy got the stuff.
They handed it to you.
Well, they didn't hand it to me. That's a very specialized skill.
Uh-huh.
To be able to write fast. The Chronicle was funny. They had the 30-30 rule, that you goal, which was, you could write 30 inches in 30 minutes with the heat on. Half in the bag, and those guys could do it because, you know, they were always in Hanno's, or they were always in M&M, which are the bars, the local newspaper bar.
Uh-huh. So you're living with a group of individuals, a particular kind of person. These don't really think about those kinds of journalists these days.
No, but, they're don't.
But
they're
I mean, they used to make movies, Cary Grant and... that other guy, I remember.
All those things like the front page.
Yes, a front page, great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I got the tail end of the golden age. So uh-huh. You know, Kane was there, Herb Kane was there, Hoppy, Art Hoppy, Stanton Delaplane, Charles McCabe. I wrote Charles McCabe's obit. Mm-hmm. He died on a Sunday. I was the city editor on a Sunday.
And were you there when Hunter Thompson was writing his column?
No.
Oh, he was the Examiner.
He worked for the Examiner.
Right, right.
I was there when, what's his name? I'll think of it in a minute. He just died. We got a Warren Hinkle.
Uh-huh.
Warren Hinkle was a real character. I was there when he was around, you know. And I knew Kane. I mean, when I went to the Chronicle, Herb Kane called me one day on the phone at my desk and welcomed me to the paper. I had written a column for the IJ called Overlook in the 70s. And it was kind of a gossip, you know, a three-dot kind of a gossip. You know, I learned a lot from Herb Kane, but not about the subject matter so much, but just the rhythm of his writing. If I ever wanted to kind of break loose a little bit, if I got stuck, I would read him just for the sound of it. Just for the beat of it, you know, because he was a real master at that. That's the trick, is the beat, you know, how he sets up his little items. So I wrote this column called Overlook, and he quoted me a few times, and, you know, he always credited me. And so when I showed up there, he said, according to Jesse Hamlin, who is now became a music writer at the Chronicle, but then he was Herb Kane's assistant. And believe it or not, he thought, Herb Kane thought, this is how insecure these guys are, how insecure we all are. He thought that they hired me to take his place. And he told me that. He said, you know, you can take my place. You can come in. I'll move right out. But I'm not ready to go yet. And I think he wrote into his 80s, right? You know, uh-huh. I think he died writing a column. Mm-hmm. I was long gone by then, mm-hmm. You know.
But interesting to think that the people that you feel are as slick can be, that really must feel the confidence of their position, so well read, so regarded, and yet they're just as insecure as everybody else.
They are, yeah, and him especially. I mean, that's probably why he was out every single night. You know, he couldn't, that was his thing. I mean, if he stopped doing that, he was nobody, you know. And he knew it, and he always dressed to the nines, you know, in suits. And he invited me over. I'll show you my item smasher. Come on over to the office, the loyal royal and all that, you know.
The item smasher.
Yeah, he had a little box so people would give him items. You know, he wrote these items.
Uh-huh.
And so he put them, the ones that he hadn't used yet, he put them in this little box, and they were on a roll. And that was, the little box was the item smasher. And then the Loyal Royal was this typewriter, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he was something else. So he invited me to come into his office one day, and it took me a while to work up the nerve to do it, you know.
What were you nervous about?
Well, it's Herb Kane, you know. I'm just a cub reporter, you know, from Marin County. I'm in my checkered cowboy shirt, my jeans, you know what I mean? And he's in his three-piece, you know, Wilkes Bashford suit, you know, and he kind of looked at me up and down, you know, this hippie kid from, you're the Paul Libertard? Yeah. Yeah. And we talked for a while, you know. And, but I mean, you know, I've never forgotten that. I mean, he appreciated what I was doing. He knew that I had a certain style that he could recognize. And, you know, in writing, that's a big deal. You know, lots of people write, you know. And, in music, if you hear Jerry Garcia play the guitar, you know immediately who it is. Mm-hmm. You hear Carlos play, mm-hmm. You know who it is. You know, and if somebody can recognize something in the way you write, the tone you strike, or the rhythm of it all, that's what you're striving for.
You know, when you describe writing, it sounds like music.
It is music to me. I'm an ear writer. I couldn't diagram a sentence. I used to be able to. I could learn how to do that, but I don't use it, so I forget it. But I write by ear. I always have. You know, how does it sound? You know?
So do you read your sentences out loud?
No.
You just feel it?
I just hear it in my head.
Hear it in your head?
Yeah, it's music in my head, you know. I can hear it.
Like, give me an example.
I'll work I've learned to write fast. I mean, this business, you can't belabor things too much, you know. You're on deadline. I got two deadlines a week, mm-hmm. You know, maybe more. And so I move copy, so. And when I'm working on daily stuff, you know, deadline is every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll work a sentence sometimes, a paragraph, you know, I think of it in terms of like building blocks. I think in my history I have bricklayers or stonemasons or something, because to me, a lot of writing is sculpting, you know, sculpture, and you build stuff, you know. It's visual too. You know, in poetry, what they call it, concrete, right? Mm-hmm. You can see it, you know. And so you see it, you hear it. That's why I don't like to dictate stuff, because I can't, you know, I don't get the experience of tactile writing it and seeing it on the page as it appeared. You know, it makes a difference.
I wish I could be inside your head, looking through your eyes. Is there any way to just say a sentence or describe this process, how you see it and hear it and how you build it and construct it, or what it is? You describe it sort of a visceral thinking thing, but it seems intuitive to me.
It's intuitive. I mean, it's talent. You know, I don't have a lot of talents, but that's one I do have. You know, I've always been able to write pretty much as well as pretty much anybody I was around. I mean, even when I went to the Chronicle, I mean, the guy sitting next to me went to Harvard, and this guy went to Stanford, you know.
San Diego State University.
San Diego State, Harvard of the West, here we are, you know. But I could compete with them, any of them, you know, and not because I have a classical education, just because I have this gift, a gimmick, you know, whatever it is. Whatever.
Gotta have a gimmick.
Yeah, but it's just a knack, you know. And, it's a knack. And some people have it, some people don't.
And your gimmick is?
My gimmick is I have the ability to relate to people with words on paper, you know, or on the screen, you know, however you want to deliver it. And I always have, since I was a little kid. I remember in first grade, you know, teacher would go around and you try to sound out words, you know, and none of the kids, there was this one word none of the kids could sound out. And I said, Paul, can you read that? Yes, yeah, it says responsibility. I can read it, no problem, you know. And so it's always been like that, you know. And it's hard to describe it because you can't think it too much, you know, it just happens it's most of the time. I mean, believe me, there are times when anybody, I don't know if you like to write or not, but I don't like to write.
I'm with John Muir. I consider it the internal grind.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like to research, and, you know, I'll research forever, but mm-hmm. then eventually you have to write.
You have to ingest, metabolize, and spit out something.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard because I don't just do it. You know, it has to be a certain standard or else I won't do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not happy with it. And, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, how you do it? How do you write a lead? You know, I don't know. It's just something that sometimes is easy, sometimes it isn't. But it's got to sound good, you know. It's got to flow. It's got to flow. It has to be. It has to. You know, people have said, you know, that my writing is smooth. Mm-hmm. That's what I try to do.
Have you ever read another person's work and just had that feeling of that is a beautifully moving sentence. John Updike.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of John Updike, but you can't copy him because he's in the class all by himself, you know. But I learned a lot about lyrical writing from him. I mean, it just blew my mind, you know, the way he would describe things, you know, oh my God. And he does it a lot. You know, it's hard to do that and maintain interest, you know. Uh-huh. But God, you know, just.
Are you a fan of Hemingway?
Yeah, I like Hemingway. I like Steinbeck more.
Yes.
Yeah, those kind of writers.
Handsome writers, I call them. Not because they're handsome, but because the words are so handsome.
Yeah, that's it.
And
that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, I like Hemingway.
There's an efficiency, but it's not efficient. Yeah. It's perfectly.
Yeah, guys like Ian McEwan now, mm-hmm. you know, he's great. I'm reading The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. She's pretty good, too, mm-hmm. It's an older style, but she's got the sound, too. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever written a book?
Yes.
And your books?
I wrote a book that was published by Grove Atlantic in New York. It's called The Road to Hell, and it was about the Stephen Bingham, George Jackson case here in Marin County. You know, the Marin County shootout, San Quentin Massacre in 1970 and 71. Yeah. It was optioned for a film twice. It just was optioned. The second option just ran out.
You've been writing about music in the IJ for a long time now.
Yeah, I've been writing about music for a long time. Not just music. Mm-hmm. I've never written just music. But yes.
You are the premier rock writer, though.
In Marin
it
County?
It seems like if ever there's going to be a good concert, somebody says, call up Paul Libitor.
Yeah, no, I'm the only one. Well, you know, when I started in 1972, there was a bunch of young reporters, me, Nels Johnson, another guy named George Nevin. We're all kids. And there was no music coverage, no popular music coverage at all in the Independent Journal, none. So, you know, we said, well, you know, let's at least start listing things so people know their shows around. The Lion's Share was going those days, George's were going, there was a lot of venues, right? And so we started something called Rock Billboard, where we just, you know, playing tonight. And anyway, these were days where Van Morrison was living in Fairfax, and David Bromberg, and, you know, Mike Bloomfield. I mean, this was some serious times, the early 70s. Late 60s, early 70s.
And Mill Valley. I've interviewed quite
Valley,
a few.
Yeah.
We've
Dan
got
Hicks
Austin DeLone.
Audie DeLone.
We've got Lauren Rowan. And
yeah, Lauren Rowan. And, you know, Peter Rowan was around then,
yes,
too.
Larry,
you know,
Craig was
Stinson
with the Prune
Beach
music.
And Mill Valley. Prune, you know. Lee Michaels.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
And Jimmy Dillon.
Jimmy was here since 69. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
So there's a lot of music over here.
Yeah, Grace Slick was living in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
David Crosby.
David Crosby, exactly.
Grateful Dead, of course.
Yeah, Bobby Weir was then here then.
Yeah.
Sammy Hagar later, a little later,
mm-hmm,
but not that much later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yes, and I was working in the Mill Valley Bureau, you know, during all that period of time. So. But there was no coverage at all. And so, you know, we started the Billboard and everything. That was one thing. But also, I started covering shows. And I covered Patti Smith at College in Marin, 1974. And I still remember the lead, sort of. And she walked out on stage, and somebody threw a flower up onto the stage at her feet. And she picked it up, put it in her mouth, chewed it up, and spit it out, and started. And then started the concert then. You know, it was when Horses was a big hit, you know, that album, classic album, Horse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's a trip, Maddie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw her again not too long ago here at Dominican.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the IG ran on our front page, page one, Patti Smith at College Marin. And then I covered Van Morrison and Jesse Colin Young,
mm-hmm,
at the Marin Civic,
mm-hmm,
page one, you know. So that sort of started the coverage, popular rock music coverage at the IG.
Do you enjoy writing about music?
Yeah, I do. I have a specialty in it. I mean, it's what I am known for. It's what I'm known for. Those are my people, you know. And I'm the only rock writer that I know of that has worked as a working musician as well. I mean, I don't hold myself up as, I'm not Jimmy Dillon. Jimmy can play. If I started right now till I dropped dead, I could never get half as good as he is on guitar. He's just a great guitar player, and he's worked at it, and he's the first one to say, you know, I've been doing this my whole life. This is the only thing I do.
Mm-hmm.
You do this other thing, but you can do this too, so, sort of, and we can work together. So that's, I work with musicians, but I'm not, I don't make a living, although I did okay this year, but I've made a living as a writer. And music is an avocation, let's put it that way. But because I know those guys, and because I can sometimes relate to them on the same level, and I, you know, I've been playing music since I was a kid, 12, 13 years old.
What is your instrument?
I play guitar and sing,
mm-hmm,
you know. So, you know, I was a folk groups in high school and all that sort of thing, college and all that. So it's something I've always done. So I knew about it already. And I was interested in it, so I started covering it. Nobody else was.
How was it for you to have musical ability yourself and an interest in music, and then all of a sudden you're meeting and writing about these people that possibly could be, that you are fans of?
Yeah.
That you're a fan of.
I played for 3 or 4 years with John Cipollina of Quicksilver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I played a lot of shows with him. I mean, that was, I'll never forget the first show I ever did. I think it was with him. It was at Starry Plow in Berkeley, something. It was also Martine Ferro, the great saxophone player. I think it was Martine's band. And I was brought in to play guitar and sing and stuff. And I'll never forget, you know, I'm setting up my stuff, and all of a sudden I look, and there's these legs coming, you know, with this incredible bat guitar that he played, you know, holding his hand. And I just feel kind of the electricity coming off.
Everybody says that about him.
Yeah, I mean, you're just like, jeez, you know, it's a rock star. He's a rock star. Yeah, and he was. And it's like, okay, you know, playing with him.
So
and I played with Gary Duncan, who was also in Quicksilver, the other guitar player in Quicksilver. He's a great player, too. And, you know, Gary wanted me to play with him in a band. I never forget, I played a little jam session with him and Greg Arrico, the drummer from Sly and the Family Stone,
mm-hmm.
in his studio here in San Rafael. So I get to hang with the heavies. You know, I played with Martin Fierro, Merle Saunders, people like that, you know, which is an experience that most of us don't get.
Do you ever play and then write with them and then write about them?
No.
No, you separate it.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a few first-person stories that probably not very good ones. Because
mm-hmm.
it's hard to do that. It's hard to separate them, you know? And sometimes it gets confusing because you don't know. Are these guys letting me play with them because?
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything. Yeah, to wonder.
I'm very aware of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very aware of it. But, you know, the truth is, they're not going to be up there and be embarrassed. They're not going to let anybody embarrass them.
No.
So, you know, and I've never embarrassed them. So, mm-hmm. you know, I hold that. I mean, I don't think I'd last very long if I couldn't hold my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I would know it, too, you know, or people would tell me. But I managed to do it. I mean, Martin Fierro used to always tell me, you know, you're up there representing your parents and your grandparents and your ancestors. It's in your blood. It's in your blood. Just let that happen. Okay. I will. That's what he would say.
Good advice.
Oh, yeah. No. I said, all right, man. I'll let it rip.
Now, Marin County and Mill Valley, there's a lot of musicians. Some of them were born and raised here. One of Mill Valley's most famous musicians, especially back in the 70s, is Bill Champlin.
Oh, yeah.
And the sons of Champlin just played at Rancho.
I just talked to Bill. You know, I interviewed him before. He played the fair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Yeah. The fair. He's also been very generous involved with Mill Valley fundraising for the art festival last year in the gala.
Right.
Which included Jimmy Dillon.
Yeah.
And Austin DeLon. Yeah. And several other musicians as well. It was quite a collection. I call them Mill Valley's musical sons.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And of course, Tamara Champlin was there as well, singing. She was the woman. But did you ever play with him?
Bill, no. No, I never did. Never played with him. I played with Terry Haggerty once or twice, you know.
Who had been in the Sons of Champlin.
Yeah, Terry was one of the founders and guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Played for years and years. You know, and of course I covered them. You know, when Bill Champlin left the Sons to go to L.A. to try to seek his fortune, I wrote the story, you know, about it. You know, about that. I've known him and written about him forever, you know. He's suffering from cancer now, so.
Hopefully not anymore.
Hope not. When I talked to him this summer, he was in chemo.
He finished his chemo.
Yeah, good.
So he was performing, yeah, I think 3 weeks ago he finished.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
He was up there performing and playing away.
I mean, I was surprised, you know, he was going to play this gig here, you know, chemo or not, he's lost his hair, he's going to wear a wig. Yeah.
Hey.
I was impressed.
He's truly a traveling minstrel.
Yeah, he
and
is.
His wife.
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah, and he's a talented, I remember him from, you know, the days, the Fairfax days, this Fairfax Street Choir and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a memory of a moment musically that stands apart? You've been here a good long while,
mm-hmm.
and you have, I'm sure,
40-something years.
Yeah, it's 40-something years. Lots of things have happened, people have come and gone, but are there moments that sort of resonate in particular in your memory, moments that moved you in some way? Or
personally, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be a moment or an event or something that just stays with you. Do you have anything in mind?
Oh, wow. There's been so many things, you know. I think for me, getting to play with some of my guys that, you know, my idols that I mentioned to you, those were experiences. And I got turned on to classical music. I got turned on to opera at one point. And I actually wrote, you know, kind of a rock and roller's take on opera for years, from about 1991 through. And Because there's a lot of similarities between rock and roll and opera, so especially at Wagner and people like that, you know, bombastic, big stuff.
Drama.
Yeah, drama. A lot of beautiful melodies. Mm-hmm. Can be.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to remember, you know, what stands out. I think... Are you talking like an individual concert that blew me away or something like that? Or?
Whatever comes to mind.
Yeah,
you know, it's very nice with these interviews to help put people, to help people to see the world that you've seen,
mm-hmm,
or appreciated,
mm-hmm,
you know. And so poignant moments mark time and place.
Yeah, one of the things that I could say is like musicians have a certain code, and, you know, of course, in a place like this, everybody knows everyone else. And so there's this camaraderie, you know. You see it locally, but you also see it on the pages of Rolling Stone. People know who you are, everyone else is. And once they get past this, the part where you're competitive, and everybody who stays in the business most of the time gets past that, and they realize that it's a brotherhood or a sisterhood or whatever it is. And so for me, to have been a part of that, not just as a journalist, but also as a player, you know, that's heartwarming to me, that I've been able to do that and play both those sides of the fence. You know, I try to separate the two, and I often do. When I'm working as a reporter, I don't try to, you know, cross over and be a musician. But I've been on the stage, you know. I've been there. I've been in the jams that take you someplace that you've never been before, you know. It doesn't happen all the time, but I felt the magic of that. And you know, I know a lot of people fantasize, oh, God, what's it like to be, you know, rocker, you know, rock and in the big leagues of rock and feel that. I felt that, you know, I felt that. And so, you know, I can go to my maker knowing that that's not something I'm going to wonder about, you know. I mean, I haven't felt it in the sense that I've had 30,000, 50,000 people, but I've had thousands, you know.
And you've had the synergy of being with other musicians and merging for that at that time and synchronicity.
Yeah, and I've seen it with Mimi and Joan, you know, with Joan a lot, you know. So I felt, you know, what it's like to feel that fame, you know, when just being with her. She can't walk down the street, you know, without being recognized. I mean, it's less and less because as we get older and people get younger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've seen all that, I've been around that. And, so I don't have any, there's no mystery about it anymore, you know, there's no like, wow, I wish I would have done that, or what was that like? So I've seen that, and I think it helps as a writer, because I'm not overly impressed by them, you know, anymore. Because
mm-hmm.
I know that they might, I can see what they're good at and what they're not good at.
So it helps you to be more objective overall.
Well,
unless,
yeah, I know more about it, you know. Yes. I know more about probably than most guys who write about music, you know. I don't, maybe not technically, but I can hear, you know. I've heard it from both ends, you know. And I know the issues. I know when somebody can't hit the notes anymore. And I also know when it doesn't matter if they hit them or not. You know? Because that's not what people are there for. They're there because they want to hear the old songs, or they remember, you know, who these people were when they were...
Or remember who they were when
they
heard
were. They remember who they were at the time. Yeah. It puts them in a certain place. So, yeah. So, yeah. But I've, you know, but my music is, you know, on the page. That's really where it is. So, you know, that's the gift I got. I got a little bit of talent musically, but not as much.
Is it gratifying to have a gift, an ability, and then be able to express it, you know, and be recognized and paid for it? Not all all artists have that.
No. Well, that's why I got into newspapers. I calculated, you know, what can I do that you write and you actually get paid for it, you know, a living wage that you can kind of, you know, get a salary or something. And, you know, newspaper reporter is the first thing I thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I haven't made a lot of money in my career. Nope, none of us really does, unless we break out and write a bestseller or something. But, you know, I've raised two kids and own three houses in Marin County, and, you know, I've done okay.
Yes, I'd say so.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a good career. It's been sad to see what's happened to it, you know.
Let's talk just briefly about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the newspaper mm-hmm. business.
Yeah.
And the changing world.
Yeah, it makes me so, it gets me angry sometimes, you know, because the newspaper business is an old kind of model. It's an old industrial startup model. You know, the ownership, the management, and the working class. You know, all the rest of us. You know, mm-hmm. from the reporters to the printers, and all those jobs are now gone, of course. But like the IJ strike, that was a class conflict. That's what that was. You know, in the most graphic sense. You know, people are getting beat up and killed and everything else, you know. So, you know, it's people's livelihood and living. And what I resented about the newspaper business, and I think helped bring about its downfall, is that it never valued its employees enough. You know, the talented among its employees. And when digital started and when the whole computer thing began, guys who were good at that left to do something else, to make their fortune, and good for them. But I think I saw that happen too many times where the newspaper didn't value, like, we need to hold on to this guy. This is the future, you know. We need to hold on to this guy. Make it worth his while to stay here, you know. Then maybe there wouldn't have been a Craigslist. Maybe we would have come up with that idea and saved ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But it bothers me that it has that we've had that adversarial relationship, you know, with ownership and with management and with these big chains that now own everything. And I think that did not serve them in the long run. You know, they may have made a lot. They were making 20-30% a year for a long, long time, and nickel and diming us. You know, we'd have to. The Chronicle had to go on strike, not while I was there, but before they did. And we threatened strike a few times when I was there. You know, just to get a raise. You know, to get, you know, basic things that we shouldn't have had to fight for. You know, really, and. So that part of it, and you know, when the digital hit, they were all caught dead. You know, they weren't ready for it.
But the IJ is still printing.
The IJ is still printing. We make most of our money on print, believe it or not.
Mm.
Although that's starting to change. You know, they're going for what they call a crossover point, where they start making more from digital than they do from the print. When that happens, it's starting to happen. It is in some areas already. So the IJ has stabilized and is now in a growth curve, I think, which has taken a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for people like me, I've seen all my colleagues go, get laid off, get bought out, retire. You know, I'm the oldest person here by a long shot. And a couple of guys who were, you know, my peers have left. So, you know, not many of my generation still doing this. Begin with.
While you're doing this, you've been around since the 60s. You've seen a lot going on. Now we have the summer, the anniversary of the Summer of Love.
Yeah.
And you've been writing about that, yes?
Yeah, and I did a whole show about it with Jimmy. Yeah.
You have, yes, you have. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Jimmy and I,
Jimmy
Dillon and I. It all started when the Mill Valley Library, was it the Library or the Historical Society? Historical Society, maybe. Asked me to come down to the library and talk about Mill Valley and rock history. Historical Society.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was a big hit. I mean, a lot of people came, and they had to move
the
it from
the
smaller...
The first Wednesday Speaker Series.
Yeah, the Speaker Series.
Yes. Right.
And they moved it up into the big main library room, and, you know, I brought my slides and did a little... slide, you know, PowerPoint thing, you know, talked about rock in Mill Valley and Marin County and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
People loved mm-hmm. it and really spotted it. It was a packed, mm-hmm. yeah, packed house. Were you there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've been in charge of the first Wednesday Speaker Series.
Oh, well,
now.
Did you call me?
No, I think that was Bill. Yes.
Bill called
before
me.
Before he left.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I invited Jimmy down. I said, Jimmy, come down. You've been around for a long time. You can be the musician's perspective. You know, we'll do this together.
Yes.
So we did. We did a little song.
And you performed.
At the end, yeah. Mm-hmm. I did a Grateful Dead song, The Days Between. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Garcia song, actually. Not really. And so somebody said, well, why don't you do that with live music, you know? And so we kind of thought about it for a while and said, yeah, let's try that. So we combined my narration and visuals with, we hired a bunch of really good local singers to celebrate Marin County Rock. So all the songs were written by Marin County. In fact, Mike Duke from Rancho Nicasio came and did a couple of the songs that he wrote for Huey Lewis. You know, we had people like that. And people loved it, you know? They thought it was... Did you say that one, too?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that was at Sweetwater. Mm-hmm. So we did at Sweetwater. I had to go get a screen. I rented a screen and did this whole thing. And people said, when are you going to do that again? That was really great, you know? So then when the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love came, you know, it was a no-brainer. I mean, we just... I looked at him, he looked at me, you know, we could do the 50th anniversary. Where? Well, you remember that story I told you about Patti Smith, the college we're in? Mm-hmm. That was produced by Sidney Goldstein, who went on to found City Arts and Lectures. Mm-hmm. And Sidney had taken over the Norse Theater in San Francisco, right around the street from Davey Hall, raised a bunch of money and refurbished it, and made this beautiful venue that they moved out of Herbst, where they did all their lecture series, and mm-hmm. moved into the Norse. Mm-hmm. And so I had written about Patti Smith at Dominican not that long ago, last year, I guess. And Sidney read it and said, yes, because I mentioned I covered her in 74 at College of Marin. Sidney wrote me an email, yeah, that was my show and everything, let's have lunch. So I had lunch with her, and she showed me the theater. And she said, do you want to use it? You know, you have a band you want to do something with it? In the summer, we don't use it that much. So I ran back to Jimmy and said, I got this theater, you know, let's put something together, let's propose something and see if she'll go for it. So we came up with a concept, you know, of using young performers to do the old songs mm-hmm. to celebrate the 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. That was the basic concept. And I would do the history too, mm-hmm. history and live music with a house band. And so I proposed it to Sydney, and she said, yeah, go for it. So we had the theater, and at first she was going to co-produce it with us, and then she decided against it because she's retiring. She didn't tell us at the time, but she's retiring, so she backed out of the producing part, but she still was very supportive and gave us a lot of things that we wouldn't ordinarily have to get started, you know. So Jimmy and I worked our butts off on this show, you know. There's a lot of stress involved in producing, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. Mm-hmm. But we knew it worked. We knew the concept worked because we'd done it before, mm-hmm. but not on this scale. So so we worked and worked and worked, and we hired Nikki Bloom, we hired the T Sisters, we hired you know, a woman from Oakland, Omega Ray, and a guy, Martin Luther McCoy, and other, a very diverse cast.
It was Joan young. Baez?
Joan Baez was our ringer, you know, she was our ace in the hole, you know. And we had 1,400 people there. Mm-hmm. It was a big hit, you know. And it went great. I mean, it went beautifully. Even better than we could have had hoped, really. Mm-hmm. So, it was kind of a triumph, you know, really. But what was so cool about it is it had an educational element. It mm-hmm. had a real history part, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked with the California Historical Society and with, you know, Jim Marshall's, you know, his estate, and with Herb Green on the East Coast, you know, to get the actual photographs from that period.
You use your ability as a journalist.
As a journalist. That was my journalism and music crossing over.
Yes.
And we did the fair, too. I'd forgotten about that. We did a smaller version at the Marin County Fair. Mm-hmm. I played in that one. I was in the band.
The county fair this last summer.
Yeah.
I mean, this summer.
Yeah, July 2nd, we mm-hmm. played on Sunday afternoon at the fair. I had a big crowd for that. And then on the 22nd of July, then we did the big show at the North.
Well,
I didn't play in that one. I sang. But
Bill Champlin was playing at the fair, too. You were all there. Was it the same day?
Yeah, he was playing on the 4th of July. Yeah. We were playing on the 2nd of July.
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, the fair I played with the band and sang and everything, but at the Norse, no, I couldn't. I had this whole other thing I had to do. But yes, it was a perfect example of combining journalism and history with music with a historical date. And by involving young people, you know, we thought we're passing this on. You know what surprised me is that some of these kids, these young singers, didn't know the songs. I mean, Nikki Bloom knew. She's already doing White Rabbit and Someone to Love. Someone to Love. She's already doing those, you know, set. But the T's didn't know about Get Together, the T Sisters, and, you know, Omega Ray didn't know Janis Joplin's music. Oh, and we hired her to do Janis Joplin.
That's just a crime.
Well, she learned it. I mean, she knew kind of, you know, but not really. And she killed it, too. I mean, she really did. And she went and saw the Janis Joplin show. I mean, she studied. But she's only 20-something, you know.
Then
Carolyn Skye, she'd never heard of the song by It's a Beautiful Day, White Bird.
White Bird.
She sang that so beautifully. She's 17 now. So no, I mean, I met her when she was 13. And she sang that so beautifully.
You're smiling while you talk about these young singers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the idea. Because people said, oh, you're getting so-and-so still alive, you're going to get him? No, we're not. We're not going to use those old guys anymore. We're going to use young people to do it. You know, because it was written by young people and performed by young people. And it's a way of passing it on. They know that music now. You know, even this handful of kids, you know, maybe they'll pass it on to somebody else.
This interview is taking place right here and now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Historical Society desires to capture the history of lots of things and the personal stories.
Right.
And you're describing the importance, or at least it appears to me that you're describing how important it is to you for you to know that these young people know these great songs.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the idea. What surprised me a little bit is that, you know, we always think everybody knows that song, right? Everybody's heard that one, but not the case. It's not true. You know, everybody knows so-and-so. They don't. You know, and why would they necessarily, you know? So yeah, history is really, I mean, I've worked really hard and been very disappointed by not being able to get a Marin Rock museum or center or something. You know, people don't like to use that word. I like the word, frankly.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't run from it. But a lot of rockers, oh, the museum, it sounds stuffy, you know. No, it doesn't.
Well, how about the bike museum?
I mean, what do people, what do people do when they go to a city, a world-class city, right? They go to the museums to see, you know, culture and history and all that stuff. What's wrong with that? I mean, rock has history. There's the Hall of Fame. And, you know, I first said, well, why don't we have a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And everybody jumped down my throat and over that. Oh, a Hall of Fame, it's only be so elitist and this and that. And I said, well, call whatever you want. You don't have to call it that. You can call it something else. But let's preserve our history here. I mean, we have an amazing history.
That's a very good idea. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, but, you know, the History Museum blew it. And, you know, that may have sunk the ship forever. I don't know. You know, and then I got involved in this effort, which is still alive, by the way, to save the record plant, Sausalito.
Mm.
The plant. And that may happen.
Maybe that could become the museum.
It might. I mean, there's a group that's trying to buy it. And it's the guy who produced, one of the principals is the guy who produced the Fleetwood Mac Rumors album there.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the art of that era. We've got still Mouse, Stanley Mouse is still around, and I remember meeting both of those Mouse and Stanley when I worked over by the plant in 1980.
Yeah.
And there was, I mean, there is, it is a culture. And it
I mean, it'd be a shame to see it go, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, if it's torn down, you go one day and it's not there anymore.
Perhaps it's something you should be talking about in a First Wednesday presentation in the future.
Well, I'd be happy to. I mean, I need to get in touch with the guys who are working it, you know, who got me involved to find out. In fact, I should probably do that anyway to find out where it is. It's been a while.
What would you say to young people, the very young people that don't even know about these fabulous songs which you're helping to keep alive? What would you say to young people about the art of writing and being a journalist in that old tradition? The importance of that or not the importance, move on, don't move on? Do you have any comments about?
Well, you know, I've been asked to speak to school groups quite a bit. In fact, I have one coming up for the second time to go talk to a journalism class at Dominican College, you know. I've spoken to their class once before, and I've talked to high schools and libraries and all kinds of places, you know, so I try to, whenever anybody asks me, to go do it. And I just tell them, just start somewhere. You know, like, how do I just start? You know, find something you're interested in that you know about or you want to tell people about, whether it's music, whatever it is, you know, plays, I don't care. And start doing it. I mean, one thing that bothers me is I don't have a protege, really. I thought I had one kid, but, you know, he went off to college. I don't know, maybe he'll come back and pick it up. But I don't have a protege, you know. There's nobody nipping at my heels, you know, trying to do what I do. And at least that I know. I don't know. Maybe they're writing for some blog or something like that. But I'm not aware of it. They are. And so that's a little disappointing to me. So I try to encourage people, young people, to just start doing your thing. I mean, like I said at the beginning, when we started the IJ, there was no pop music coverage here. Nobody assigned us to do it. We just started doing it, you know, and kept doing it. And it sells, you know, people want to read it. So, you know, if it didn't, it would have died a long time ago. So that's what I say, you know, just writers write, two words. And musicians play. You know, I have people say, you know, they're in their 20s. Right? I think maybe I'd try a career in music. Well, if you haven't tried it already, it's like, it doesn't work that way. You know, you've got to be doing it all the time. You know, you don't all of a sudden become something. So, you know, I don't know what your experience is, but that's been mine. It's a little bit disconcerting that there's no one to really pass it on that I'm aware of at the moment. Maybe somebody's reading, you know, maybe I'm doing it.
Maybe somebody listening. Is this an invitation to contact you?
Oh, absolutely. I've always kept that door open.
How accessible are you if somebody should?
Well, I'm fairly accessible. I mean, I don't have all the time in the world, but I was working with a kid that I met through the Lobby Lounge. We haven't talked about that.
Talk about the Lobby Lounge.
Yeah, Lobby Lounge was an effort by me and Robert Sterling, the editor here, to involve young people in the newspaper. You know, I went to a community meeting at Mill Valley, in the Mill Valley Library downstairs somewhere in the middle of
the room. Mm-hmm. And everybody, room.
Yeah, and everybody was there, was like between 50 and 80, which is fine. You know, that's our readership, but that's all there was, right? So I just went, God, I went to Robert and said, man, what can we do? I said, music, we intersect, where do we intersect? Music and technology, right? With young people. So we created this Lobby Lounge video concert series. And we did it in our lobby when we had a bigger lobby than we have now.
Here at the IJ offices.
Right here. Yeah, mm-hmm. right there. We used to be in this bigger space. We moved a year and a half ago. So. And the lobby was big enough. So we started having kids. Caroline Skye was one of them. Mm-hmm. One of the first ones to come in, and a couple of photographers. One guy did sound, one guy did lights, one guy did cameras. I booked it and emceed it. And we started doing this video series, and it's now in its third year. This is the third year. I'm just starting again, you know, this fall. And at the end of the series, we did a live show at Showcase Theater in conjunction with the county cultural affairs.
Showcase Theater over at the Civic Center.
Yeah, 300, almost 400 seats, mm-hmm. The Civic Center, yeah. So we've done 2 years of that, you know, and having young people perform, you know, we had the Drums of Fire, the Davidson Junior Middle School Steel Drum Band this past night. They were amazing. And we had the Drake Jazz Band, and we had a junior high school or middle school jazz group from Nevada that was just killed, you know. And people like Carolyn Skye, singer-songwriter types, and all that. So I started that to get young people involved with IJ, and they are. I mean, they go, they look at the videos, and, you know, they appreciated it. They appreciate the opportunity, which is another thing. I didn't know if they'd be indifferent or not, you know. The newspapers, no, I don't want to do it. But they do. They show up, and they're really thrilled. I mean, they walk into that theater, some of those kids, and see that it's a real theater for the first time. It's really, you know, you can see the impression.
That's a moment.
Yeah, it's a moment. Yeah.
And perhaps even a confidence builder in preparation for further moments.
Yeah, I mean,
is their interest.
Yeah, now we shoot stuff in the media center in San Rafael. They have a studio there. It's not big enough, but That's where we go. Yeah.
So calling all young artists, calling all young musicians.
Yeah, if we can help you.
Calling young writers.
Yeah, right.
I have a question I often ask at the end of an interview, and I'll ask you now. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
Well, you're quite good at this, actually. You know, I do this a lot myself, so
it's a little different.
I can appreciate it's different being on the sand.
Being on the other side, yes.
And like often happens when I'm on your side, I'll go away from this thinking, oh, I should have asked this or that, and I should have brought up something. But I think you've done a really, really good job with it. I mean, what is it about Marin County that makes it special, that makes this a musical place? That's something that's sort of a mysterious thing, you know. People say they're inspired by place, you know. The geography of hope, you know, the thing that they do out in West Marin that they started, that Steve Costa and them started out there.
Yes, I have attended.
Yeah, you have? Yeah. So
yes, with my friend Betty Girk, who taught
So I think the place itself, Marin County itself as a place, has influenced music, you know, the way music's done. I mean, I interviewed Steve Miller a few years ago, and where'd you like Fly Like an Eagle? In Novato. I moved to Novato. You know, I wrote in Novato. Really? Novato, eh? Okay. And, you know, it's a cool song, Fly Like an Eagle. You see the red-tailed hawk spinning around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of what makes this place so interesting and so rich is the sense of place that somehow comes out in it. All the people who've passed through here, you know, from blues guys. Why did all the blues guys from Butterfield Band end up in Marin County? You know, Elvin Bishop, Mike Bloomfield, Mark Naftalin. Elvin's still here, you know. Nick Gravenitis. How does that happen? Why did they all come here?
Are you called or do you look for something?
Yeah.
That's always the question.
Yeah, right. So it's a really special place in a lot of ways, you know. And I hadn't planned on talking about that because it's not me, it's not personal, but that's something I've observed, you know, through time, and which is another reason it's important to preserve a little of this history. And I'm trying to my best, you know, to write it, you know, what do they call it, daily history or whatever, to keep it, you know, write it, but I'd like to see it somehow preserved in one place, like you're doing with oral histories and all that, which could be part of some sort of a Marin Music Center or something like that. Yeah. In addition to oral histories, it could be, you know, you go into a booth and listen to all the songs that have been written in Marin County. I mean, you could sit in there for days, probably.
Oh, let's just name some of them.
Well, Fly Like an Eagle, Do You Know What I Mean? White Rabbit, Somebody to Love. Not Get Together, that wasn't written here, but the guy who wrote it,
Jesse Colin Young.
Dino Valente wrote it.
Dino Valente wrote that.
Yeah, Chet Powers. If you look at the music, it says Chester Powers. That's Dino Valente. That's his real name.
Huh.
How he got that name?
Classic song.
He looks like a Dino. It's a great song, you know. And he moved here. You know, I had him, and we opened our show with that song. You know, Get Together.
Coming Back to Me.
Coming Back to Me.
Although not written here. You know, I interviewed Marty recently.
You're right.
And that actually wasn't written here, but it was quite a story. But it does make me think of this area somehow.
And Today.
Today.
Yes. Jerry Garcia had a lot to do with those songs. He plays guitar on them. When you listen to Cyrilis Capillo, that's one of the main guitar players is Jerry Garcia.
Yes.
You know.
Other songs, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Dock of the Bay. That was in the show. That was in our show, too?
Yes.
We had Martin Luther McCoy sang that one. Oh, I mean, it's a long list, you know.
There's a lot of songs that have to do with love.
All the Grateful Dead songs.
Oh,
all the Robert Hunter, Jerry Garcia, lots of them were written here, you know. I mean, that's a huge catalog.
Yeah.
All the stuff that Bobby Weir wrote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
David Bromberg was here. He wrote a lot of stuff. He was here. Van Morrison.
David Crosby.
Tamil Pius Hyatt.
At 3 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah, at 3 a.m. 3 p.m.
3 p.m., is that it?
Yeah, he'd go down there and ogle a lot of people. Yes. That's fine. Yeah, wooden ships.
Yes.
I mean, it's fascinating.
Yes.
You know? So it's important to keep, to preserve all that, you know, to take credit for it. Or
so that's your...
Nurture it.
You know, too. I appreciate what you're saying, the importance of holding history, of preserving it and putting it in a place that's accessible for others to truly experience it. Let's keep that in mind for the future.
Okay.
You know, maybe it's the birth of something right here with your interview.
Yes. We'll revive our efforts to do that. You know, before I croak, you know, maybe we'll have something.
You
like
look
that.
Pretty good.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Anything else we should talk about?
Not that I can think of at the moment, actually. Is there anything about Mill Valley in particular?
Sure. Do you have a special something to mention about Mill Valley?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I told you the Mimi story pretty much. You know, for me, that's a big part of it.
I like Jimmy's story about Jimmy Dillon's story. He's a neighbor of mine, you know, and he says whenever he wants work, he just goes and sits at Equator, sits down and talks to people, and usually something comes up. That's community.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And we have this Rockmorton Theater and Sweetwater.
And the second theater, and the Sweetwater. I mean, we haven't talked about Jeannie Patterson, you know, and the original Sweetwater. I spent many, many hours in that place.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my first dates with Mimi was sitting at the bar in the original Sweetwater.
Mm-hmm. On Throckmorton.
On Throckmorton, yeah.
Yes.
That one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeannie was, if there was ever a woman who was like the heart and soul of Marin County music during a certain period, it was her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's the one who made Sweetwater famous and nationally known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people came because of her. Because of her taste, her good taste, and just her spirit, you know, that she had.
And she didn't know what she was doing.
She had no idea.
I spoke with her on the phone. Her husband bought the Sweetwater for $2,000, and she just jumped.
Yeah,
she
didn't know.
She just did it.
She didn't have, she didn't know anybody. She started building her little Rolodex, you know.
Living in her little apartment above El Paseo.
Yeah.
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 Perhaps that's the takeaway from this interview for those that might be listening. If you're compelled to do something, just do it.
Nobody's going to do it for you.
And you may not even think you're prepared, nonetheless.
Yeah, who is? You know, we're never prepared. Before we did, Jim and I did the show, I didn't know how to do this. You know, and he didn't either. I mean, we both learned. He knew some things. He knew more than I did. But we learned a lot just by jumping in. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he and I were talking. We're both... We're both clean and sober, right? We have been for a long time. And we were talking one day when it was getting kind of close to it, and it's like, are we going to pull this off? Or not? You know, you go through so many challenges and so much stress. You're like, what have I gotten myself into? You know, that date is looming so large, I can't relax until I'm through with this. You know, it's on my mind all the time. And, you know, he and I were talking, and he said, you know, Paul, it's just about overcoming fear. That's all it is. It's just, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know? Maybe it flops, so what? You know, people will forget about it in 10 minutes. Maybe we won't, but that's probably the worst thing. Nobody's gonna die or anything. And just overcoming fear. So, you know, so what do you choose? Do you choose peace or conflict or love over fear? Yeah, I don't know. I'll take love every day of the week, you know? And so that's a lot of it. People are afraid or they don't think they can, or how are you going to know?
Unless you go.
Gotta go.
Well, I think that's a really good way to end this
interview. Yeah, I do too. That's very good. Thank you.
Paul, thank you so much
for
sharing your story and your wisdom and your experience and taking us on a journey through your life, seeing the world through your eyes. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You're very welcome.
So on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, this concludes your interview.
Yay!
Yay!